Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Audrey, and my co-host, Mehdi and Steffi. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public policy discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at beyond_headlines. That is BYOND_headlines. Today, we'll be discussing the most pressing issue, which is the housing crisis. Contributions are being made to tackle the housing crisis on a large scale, from government commitments to developers realizing their targets that needs to be met for more housing supply. Though with every new promise for a better and brighter future are present in news reports, parts of Canada working desperately to tackle the housing crisis that is affecting so many Canadians. Today, we are honing in on the topic of the housing crisis and how Toronto can remain a resilient city in the future. Every levels of government and nonprofits are working toward finding the best methods to resolve the pressing housing crisis for the future generations. Jad Al-Ghali from the New Majority will bring the perspective on the housing crisis and the challenges they are facing as they work with youth for their future. Before we question our guest speaker about their point of view on the rapid housing crisis, I want to give our listeners a little bit of background. It is essential to understand what is the housing crisis. Well, a housing crisis occurs when there is an extended and increasing scarcity of affordable housing and the housing supply falls far short of demand. Most major cities are experiencing this problem as strong economic growth has led to massive population growth and skyrocketing housing prices. Now, this is the textbook fact, but there is much more to the housing crisis, which is that the housing crisis is depriving people from having shelter. It is one of the basic human needs. Canada's housing crisis has been heavily covered and analyzed from how it is fueling homelessness, pushing families out of big urban centers, and leading to more and more people living at home with their parents. These viewpoints have only focused on how it affects people's housing. In reality, the housing shortage affects everything else as well. Well, now it poses the question that how did this housing crisis develop exactly? To answer it, the housing crisis dates back 2 years ago, as it has been an issue that has been going on for a long, long time in Canada. Housing crisis started with the governments playing hot potato with the responsibilities of who is in charge, because it is technically nobody's responsibility. In Canada, initially, in the 1980s, the federal government and provincial government dealt with the housing. But in November 1999, federal government and Ontario signed Ontario-Canada contract, where province had the flexibility to administer social housing programs. Along with Ontario, many other provinces took on the responsibility of building more housing as a provincial responsibility. Later, when the provincial government couldn't do it, the provincial government put the responsibility to the municipalities without giving them any support for the systematic rules. The housing crisis didn't emerge just suddenly. It unfolded over several years. One of the contributing factors was the culmination of various elements, with interest rates dropping from their peak in the 1980s, reduced state involvement in housing, and new CMHC policies, such as enhanced mortgage protection and significantly lowered down payment requirements, a foundation was laid for what was anticipated to be an enduring housing boom. The initial years of this boom were marked by a semblance of affordability. It was during this period that housing began to shift into a significant investment asset, a process known as financialization. As interest rates decreased, housing prices gradually rebounded from the lows experienced in the 1990s recession. The inclination towards home ownership, influenced with less government spending and more money circulating in the economy, which aligned with long-standing provincial and city-level policies, including exclusionary zoning and lax rent controls, Cultural beliefs such as the importance of owning a single family home or prioritizing car ownership further reinforce this trend. Government isn't needed in the development industry as much anymore. Due to no intervention from and continuous long years of poor policy making around the housing development from the government side, the developers have been building housing only for the rich, leaving very little affordable units. It is said that it is due to the relationship between strong population growth and supply shortage that is generating the friction, made worse in many cities by municipal rules and regulations that restrict development and community associations that resist the construction of concentrated affordable housing units. As our economy grew, that only resulted in a lack of housing. Put together with many other things, it has resulted into lack of infrastructure, not enough to meet the needs of the people. Federal government and all levels of government has become aware of the housing crisis now and are actively working on it. It is true that the federal government is investing large sums of money to support new housing construction, but the reality is that it isn't possible to rapidly scale up new housing construction without also investing in the municipal infrastructure that supports it. Amongst many causes, one of the causes of preventing us now from building more housing would be that developers need incentives to build more housing structures, and it has become even more expensive. One of the most expensive thing would be the labor cost, the building permit cost, the zoning permit cost, and so many other things. Additionally, the process of municipalities responding to the paperwork is very lengthy. Most of the units or lots that are being the developers want to develop on are need to be rezoned, so the process back and forth takes a long time. This is only forcing developers to shy away more from investing in housing. With that brings us to the government's role and the institution's roles and barriers within our system, which will be discussed by our guest speaker, Jad Al-Ghali. Jad has extensive experience with issues affecting the youth. He has been part of New Majority and has ran for school board trustee for the Panel District School Board. We bring him today as guest to discuss the housing crisis and how it has affected the youth. Today, we'll hear from Jad Al-Ghali about his experience in this role, what he has learned since then, and what he expects for the future of Toronto.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Before we begin with discussing the housing crisis and how it affects youth in various ways, could you please explain what the New Majority is as an organization?
Of course. So New Majority, when I was there, of course, it was Future Majority. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that's committed to engaging with politicians and the political realm of Canada and trying to push youth issues and youth-centered policies on the national and provincial stage. The reason why we've had the remarketing from Future Majority to New Majority is because just recently, voters under 30 have become the majority in the province of Ontario and in Canada as a whole.
So, Mike, from that, my question would be like being from a generation that, well, while growing up, we hadn't seen the housing crisis from a very young age, but now difficult times are coming, as we have been told by adults. And I was just wondering that I feel it is a harsh thing to realize that we might not be able to afford housing. As I was looking over Toronto's housing crisis plan, I felt myself getting nervous reading over the focus area and priority actions that aim to prepare city homes and neighborhoods for things. In your opinion, what are the potential reasons behind the housing crisis at the moment?
So that's a very important question, and the sentiment that you have, you're not alone in. I remember during the last provincial election, I was invited by Centennial College on a panel, and we were discussing youth issues as well. And we had someone ask us about doomerism, and that was the first time I've heard that phrase. And I was like, sorry, I know what boomers are, but what's a doomer? And so they explained that doomerism is this new concept amongst young people where they feel like they are doomed. Like there's no point in working towards any goal because The whole world is against them, everything's stacked against them, and there's no prospect of like there's no light at the end of the tunnel, including buying a house. And there's a lot of different reasons for why we've come to this point. The Canadian housing market has become an international commodified market. It's no longer just a market of housing, but it's an investment market for foreign direct investment and people looking to invest their money, and they do so by buying houses in the Canadian market, keeping them empty and using them as commodities. One of the main issues that we look at when we're seeing the commodification of our housing market is where is the government, right? And the housing crisis has been able to grow as much as it has because of our federation, whereas the federal government will step out and say this is a provincial issue. The provincial government will say, no, you know what, we need the federal money for supporting housing initiatives. Realistically, the federal government hasn't really interacted with housing since the 1970s. 1980s, they kind of stepped back, and in 1992, after the Charlottetown Accord, they basically said, oh, you know what, we're officially recognizing it as provincial jurisdiction. So I would say the first and foremost cause of it is a lack of awareness or clarity in terms of whose jurisdiction is it, whose problem is it to solve. Because a lot of times we see people coming and blaming the city of Toronto or the city of Vancouver, when realistically municipalities do not have the resources, do not have the funding, and do not have the ability to solve these issues. So you're going to need to see significant investment from the federal government, and you need significant leeway from the provincial government in order to do so. I think we're starting to see that happening. And most notably, we saw that in Calgary a couple of years back, when the city of Calgary subverted the provincial government and went straight to the feds in order to get housing support. Once provinces see that municipalities are willing to go straight to the federal government, I think they'll slowly start to step up and start to put in the ramifications that are needed.
So that was a great answer. I like how you touch on the topic of doomerism and this being such a new issue that we've never seen before. Like you might have said, we have seen boomerism affecting one generation, and now doomerism is one that affects our own. And it's interesting how the interplay of lack of hope and motivation can come into these feelings and sentiments that youth have. And given your perspective on doomerism and youth, who do you think is most affected by the housing crisis?
So from the housing crisis perspective, I'd say young adults, most definitely. I know previously in Canada, you had the average age of people leaving their parents' house at around 17, 18, sometimes as young as 16. Today, you're seeing it as upwards of 27 towards 30, people leaving their parents' houses, or many of them, unfortunately, waiting on inheritances from their parents in order to actually put a down payment on a house. By far, our generation and the generations above us and right below us are going to be hit the hardest with the housing crisis. Right now, your median salary for someone living in Toronto is about $55,000 to $65,000 a year. In order to live comfortably, you need around $75,000, and that's for rent, not for owning your own house. So, with inflation, with inaccessible mortgages, extremely high mortgage rates, and on top of that, mortgage insurance is because you obviously don't have the income to get that mortgage. You cannot access the housing market, and let alone buying a house, you can't even access the rental housing market in Toronto today. Just recently, I have one of my friends moving from Montreal to Toronto, and I was helping her find a house, and she was caught off guard with the idea that we have auctioning for rental housing. We have bidding. I don't know how many places around the world you're going to go and you're going to see rental bidding for apartments. And it's honestly atrocious, the state of the housing market today. Not only that, but even if you do get one and you overextend yourself in order to outbid someone else for the rental market, a lot of the new buildings being built today, I think 2020 and upwards, are not rent controlled, are not forced to be rent controlled in the province of Ontario. So realistically, you're overextending yourself in order to get a house without actually knowing if you're going to be able to keep the house later on. So by far, I think the people most affected are going to be either the median to lower income brackets people and the younger people who did not benefit from the economic booms and the low inflation and the lower housing rates that we used to have, pre-2000s.
I really like the idea of how you mentioned that as the housing prices have risen, the wages haven't kept pace with it, which is sort of which is detrimental to the youth because it makes housing inaccessible for them. So just like sort of driving on the same issue, keeping on the same issue, but driving towards like the youth and their health, I wanted to ask a question. How do you think the housing crisis is affecting the well-being of communities and the mental health, especially of the youth, and especially of the ones who are most impacted by the housing crisis?
Of course, the housing crisis that we have today is heavily affecting not just individual health, but societal health as a whole. If we look at the individual, when you think about your house, you think of security, you think of stability. That's the place you go, that's your home. People are not being given the opportunity to be able to find that peace, comfort, and stability of their own. Whether it's because you're living in precarious situations with your parents, with your relatives because you don't have the funds to move in on your own, and you have that lack of freedom, lack of individualistic priorities, or whether you've overextended yourself, you found a house, and you're not sure whether you're going to be able to afford it next year when your landlord comes back and raises the rent tenfold because you're in a place with no rent control, and you don't know if you're going to actually be able to afford the place because you can barely afford it today. So people no longer have the stability or the confidence in their ability to find a house or in their ability to retain a house if they do find one. And I'm just talking about people in Toronto, which honestly is not even the worst housing crisis in Canada. You're looking at Vancouver. So all in all, it really takes a drain on a person by not knowing where they stand, not being able to find their freedom in finding their own house and being self-sufficient in that manner. And on top of that, when you have that kind of pressure on you, you don't give back to society as much as you want to. On top of that, you also have areas now, whether it be in Mississauga or Toronto, that are starting to have infighting regarding how they want to go about building more accessible, more affordable housing. In Mississauga, we had a whole issue about people living in suburbia who don't want a condensified downtown core next to them. They don't want high rises. They don't want multiplexes. They don't want any of that stuff. But at the same time, you can't expect a city to grow, provide affordable homes, and help those in need without fundamentally changing the way city works and what your infrastructure looks like. On the other end, in Toronto, the way that they've been going about it, I don't think has been ideal. You have a lot of people now who are worried about having any sort of affordable housing project next to them because they feel that that's going to take down the value of their properties. So again, it comes back to the whole idea of commodification of the housing market. It's no longer seen as something that people need. It's only seen as a pillar of life. It is seen as an investment solely by people inside Canada and outside.
I just wanted to ask, even though this is a very tough situation that we are in, how would you recommend the youth to sort of navigate their way in through this like tough times? Like, what would be the most effective way for the youth?
By far, engaging with your elections, engaging with your politicians. And this is something that I wholeheartedly believe, and it's a hill I will die on, trying to get young people to go out to vote. In the last federal election, we had around 53% of eligible voters between the ages of 18 to 24 out at the polls in 2019. In that same election, we had 79% of individuals between 65 and 74. This is something that I always tell people or anyone who asks or whenever I talk about this subject. Canadian politicians do not care about Canadians, period. Canadian politicians care about Canadians who vote. That's it. They care about retaining their power. They care about winning elections. So when they look at the same statistics they look, okay, you know what, young people, only 53% came out to vote in 2019 versus almost 80% of the age group 65 to 74. Who do you think they're going to cater their policies towards to? Who do you think that they're going to take into account when sitting down and creating their legislation? They don't care about the younger people because they don't vote. That's what they think. They have the idea that we're apathetic, that we don't really care, we don't engage. So what's the point of trying to reach out to us? We need to make them court our vote. If we go out in hordes, represent ourselves, vote, I promise you, Canadian politicians will only create policy that caters to us, that targets us, that tries to get us on their side. But as long as we're content with what they're giving us, and as long as we're silent, they don't even care if we're happy. They care if we're silent. We don't vote. Perfect. Great. But if we vote, then they're going to start fearing us, that they're going to start wanting us to like them. And provincially, I think the voter turnout was around 20%. That's laughable. I mean, what government is going to start creating real policies or real change if they see that, you know, only 20% of the province came out to vote? In their heads, that means, oh, people are happy. No need to change anything. But if we come out in hordes and we start voting, that sends a real message. And I know it can seem so, you know, useless if you don't like any of your options, and you know you're getting to the point where you're trying to vote for the best case scenario or not the worst case scenario. But it's more about making your voice heard, and it's more about showing the politicians that you're there, you're listening, and you're seeing what they're doing, and you will hold them accountable.
Thank you. Yeah, that's an excellent point. And it is interesting how we see how a lot of these properties are being made into investments when really it's a basic human right, really, to have housing. We should see it through that frame. And what is interesting also is how supply and demand seems to be the center of this problem, but not just supply, but supply of affordable housing for youth. And you mentioned how rent bidding comes into this as a unique problem in our area, and which is also kind of a demand issue. We could think of it in that sense. So as a non-for-profit organization, what challenges do you believe are preventing us from building more homes?
So when it comes to building more homes, and this is a very somewhat controversial topic, especially if you ever go to city council meetings, it's a very big issue. The way I see it is developers have been vilified by younger generations and all that. Rightfully so, because you know it's all about controlling that demand. By withholding a supply, they were able to create increased demand and increase the prices, therefore leading to the provincial government taking rent control off all buildings being built after 2020 to try to stimulate more development. 100% I get it. But at the end of the day, we have to realize that politicians and developers must work together for one goal, and that's to help us. Now, the question is who can we persuade? We don't have any power over the developers, but like I said, we have all the sway over politicians since we put them there. So it's about trying to get people who are able to create those positive bridges and relationships between the developers and between legislation that make it both, yes, lucrative towards them because that's their end goal is profit, but also beneficial for our society. Part of this is by ensuring that every new development has an affordable housing scheme, like a part of it, whether it be 30 to 50% or more, reserved for affordable housing, not for commodification. And government can do this easily by withholding permits, by creating legislation. And although we've seen a lot of promises by government to do such things, none of it has been, I want to say, positively put forward. Recently, we did have, like, for example, the Canadian government does have a program for first-time home buyers where it will purchase, it's a kind of cost-sharing program where it will purchase 10% of a house with you up to $400,000. Show me one house in Toronto or the GTA that costs less than $500,000. You can't. So if this program leaves out one of the major housing crisis areas because it's not applicable to it or it won't help it, then what's the point of this program? So we really want to think about when they're putting these programs forward, what are they taking into account? Is it really going to help the end user or not? Because I can give you a whole list of all the programs that they have, but the problem is all these programs are being done in an economic way. I on paper, yeah, look what we're providing. But realistically, who's going to be able to take advantage of it? If I go and I'm trying to do the First Time Home Buyers Act, I'll get maybe $40,000 for a house. That is not enough for me to put down a down payment, and it is definitely not enough for me to get a decent mortgage in order to buy a house. Over that, because it's going to be less, I'll also be paying insurance to the government for whatever mortgage I do take out. So realistically, it's a catch-22. It's not really helping me. It's just giving me the illusion of having options when realistically I don't.
So, sorry, I just wanted to ask you on that. Like, when you talk about sort of the challenges of how, let's say, the government is not doing enough, right? So, I wanted to talk to you about what could be the federal role in it, because we heard like Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, he stated in a Hamilton press conference on July 31st, 2023, he said, and I quote, "I'll be blunt, housing is not a primary federal responsibility. It's not something that we have direct carriage of." So when you see the federal government sort of saying stuff, like sort of saying, making statements like that, so what would you say would be the federal role in this? Because they have, as you mentioned earlier, that they can control through funding. So how would you say that the federal, how can the federal government navigate its role in this crisis?
This is a long time critique of mine about the federal government is it chooses when it has power and doesn't have power. It's phenomenal, honestly. The federal government in Canada holds the biggest power because it has the most money. It has taxation power. It has access to funds that provincial governments and municipal governments do not. I'll be blunt as well. Provincial governments, no, I don't think a lot of them could afford the overhaul of the housing system that it needs. But the federal government could subsidize that if it saw a benefit. For example, when the federal government aided Calgary in its request, it wasn't because it cared about housing. I'm pretty sure it was because it wanted to undermine the Alberta provincial government. And that's usually how things go. And if you have mayors of big cities like Toronto, Vancouver, Mississauga, going to the federal government, I'm sure the federal government will also pledge help towards them. But my problem here is it shouldn't be a one-off whenever things get tough. It should be taken as part of the responsibility to ensure Canadians have access to such houses. And it's just in general, priorities do seem a bit off. We did have a federal government promise to provide around $4 billion for Indigenous housing when they don't even have proper pipe systems or water supplies. So it's always about promising money that they can, but where's the money going? Are you prioritizing? Are you building an infrastructure first for the houses currently available before you're starting to build more houses when you don't even have clean water systems going? It's ridiculous. Like, it's a bit of a side note, but in Canada that we still have water advisories, a country like us still having water advisories for many of our communities. That is not okay. So it's all about stopping the blame shifting and about putting your money where your mouth is. And it's about actually going in and creating plans. Another critique I will say about the federal government specifically is a lack of lived experience in their policy proposals. When you have politicians who most of them have two homes, one in Ottawa and one in their home riding, talking about housing. And the federal government, there was a scandal about an MP buying and flipping houses on the side. When you are part of the problem, and respectfully, you are not part of the people who can't afford houses with your salaries, you need lived experience. You need younger people at the policy table who are not just yes men, but actual thinkers about how to best approach this topic before you can come out and do all these policy proposals. And I think it's a very big cop out whenever, and not just the federal government, you've seen multiple provincial governments say it at the same time, whenever they come and say, not my jurisdiction. You're an elected official, respectfully, it is your jurisdiction.
Yes,
Thank you.
absolutely. And to expand on your point, you likely see the work or lack thereof of various levels of government? And in this case, what institutional barriers do you think the levels of government face while aiming to solve the housing crisis?
There's a lot of bureaucratic red tape. I've been criticized before for saying I somewhat like bureaucracy because it keeps things check in order and the balances in check and all those different things. But too much of it is just red tape and is a barrier to genuinely solving problems. The biggest, I would say, barrier, especially when it comes to housing in terms of jurisdictional issues, I would say is municipal governments. A lot of people like kind of it's an oversight for them is that municipal governments technically, realistically, are not recognized by our constitution. They're not recognized as legitimate governing bodies. They were just put under the provincial government as kind of like, here, you deal with these. Because back then, you didn't have Toronto, the state of Toronto, and like big cities like that. They were little suburb communities. So they were seen as a drain on the system that were just put under the provincial government. Today, that has shifted wholeheartedly. They are the pulse of the Canadian economy. Toronto, Mississauga, Vancouver, all big cities all across Montreal, Quebec City. So re realistically, it's time to maybe look at what are basically the rights and privileges of municipal governments. What can they do? Where is their funding coming from? Is it self-sufficient in order to basically take on the tasks that they're given or not? Because if they're basically being given more responsibility than they can afford, then that's something that really needs to be addressed, and they cannot be at the mercy of the province all the time, which is realistically what they are. The premier can come and get rid of a municipality if he wants without even like going through legislation. Just, I don't like this city. So that's a huge barrier for municipalities. They always have to play very nice with the provincial government in order to stay on their good side. And, sometimes, like in the case of Calgary, they kind of go to the federal government for support. So I think more realistically in the future, the bulk of that responsibility, and, I would support it, the logistical bulk of it should be within a municipal government who's our most direct form of democracy in the country, who basically know, their population, what their population wants, what their needs are, but subsidized and funded by provincial and federal government.
Yes, there is a lot of bureaucratic red tape, people could argue. And I think the province's approach to this thus far we've seen has been the use of municipal zoning orders or MZOs in the province to sort of override the local municipality's zoning bylaws and to speed up the process. And I know there's been quite a lot of controversy around this issue as it does take away from the oversight of municipal governments. However, do you think there is a lack of data, perhaps on the housing market, when you're trying to research and analyze information that you can use to ultimately advocate for youth?
Oh, 100%, definitely. This comes not just from, I guess, the lack of resources put into collecting that data, but it's also because the data is quite scattered. You don't have basically one body looking at this. You have NGOs, you have multinational corporations looking at it as a commodified market, looking at it. You have provincial government, federal government, which for some reason their research are completely separate institutions. And then you have different municipalities' own researchers into their cities. So not only is there, like, I guess, a lack of viable information and accurate information and dated information, but you also have disunity amongst the projects going on, which I think would be better kept if they had one unified approach. I just want to quickly comment about the MZOs and all the different ideas that, especially when we're seeing in Ontario, is when we saw the concept of the province building on the green belt. You have a lot of underdeveloped areas of Ontario. If you go north, you will see masses of land, okay, ready for development. So again, it's this idea that it's always pushing a specific kind of idea, and it's always centered around one city. They build up one city like Toronto and build up around it. That's not efficient. We need more cities in Canada. If you look at the United States, you have a plethora of cities. In Canada, realistically, you think about it, what cities come to mind? You have Calgary, Edmonton, and Alberta. You have Toronto and Mississauga, and maybe Brampton in and Niagara Falls in Ontario. You have Quebec City and Montreal in Quebec. We don't have a diversified amount of cities because we always like to build in the same areas and around little hubs. And a lot of that is because of the lack of infrastructure elsewhere. You go up North Ontario, you're going to have a real tough time commuting anywhere. You leave Toronto and you come to Mississauga, you're going to have a tough time commuting anywhere because you don't have the same communication systems, transportation systems as you do in Toronto. So this is all part of the housing crisis in that you don't see government investment in infrastructure that makes it conducive, or even if you want profitable for companies to come and do it in terms of building housing.
Jad, I wanted to sort of transition the conversation from like institutions, structures, the challenges into the rental market. And like I wanted to bring, because rental market is an interesting situation, right? Because let's say that the federal government passed a rental construction financing initiative, which was to provide low cost loans to developers, right? But then there's an institutional problem that comes up, which is that zoning is a provincial, sorry, a municipal, well, it is a provincial right under the constitution, but obviously they pass it on to the municipalities, right? Which sort of creates conflicts because a lot of zoning permits, especially in Toronto, are for single family detached houses and not for large rental development units, right? So sort of municipal provincial policies incentivizes the developers to go towards the provincial towards the single family detached houses rather than developing large rental units. So from that, I wanted to ask a question. How's the rental market being affected, you say, in terms of availability and affordability because of the housing crisis?
So when we're looking at basically the rental market in terms of the housing crisis and how it's affecting it, 100% you've touched on a very important aspect, which comes to intergovernmental fighting. And then, of course, there's going to be another one, which is about where are these new developments going? To quickly touch upon the concepts that you were talking about in terms of provincial government, municipal government, all these different things. We have to understand that municipal governments basically cater towards municipal residents mostly. They have the most direct contact with their constituents. A lot of people, and this is kind of what gets me agitated whenever I see people that don't vote in municipal elections and they think, oh, it's just municipal. Municipal politicians have the most effect on your daily life. When you step out onto the street every single day, the first thing that you will see is the effect of your municipal government. When you have salt on your driveway, no salt on your driveway, too much snow, pushed onto your driveway, your garbage being picked up, not picked up, all that is municipal affairs. Whether you have a bike lane coming right in front of your driveway or not, municipal. Whether your area is jurisdiction for businesses and condos or condos only, municipal. So when people, don't go out to vote for municipal elections because they think it's not that big of a deal, they affect your life a lot more than federal elections where you're basically, that's mostly foreign policy. You're really looking at municipal politicians as the people who are controlling your day-to-day life. So the biggest, I guess, difference here is like municipal governments will hear a lot of pushback from their residents whenever they approve changing jurisdiction and changing zoning. People will come out to city hall meetings. People will make their voices heard, and people will tell the politicians what they want and what they don't want. Provincial governments, not so much. When you go and you watch the debate in Queen's Park, you're not allowed to talk, you're not allowed to clap, you're not allowed to do anything. You're up in the stands. When you go to a city hall hearing, you have a chance to make your voice heard. So in general, you have municipal governments that are a lot more cautious about change in these areas because they will hear about it constantly, whereas provincial governments are more detached. So in all, you realistically, we are going to have to see multi-zone areas. We are going to have to see the restructuring of zoning in order to make headway for all the housing that we're going to need. Again, this brings me back to my previous point when it comes to provincial government, prioritizing the rezoning in these municipalities rather than creating new areas where they can build housing by expanding provincial infrastructure, by expanding the GO train lines, the TTCs, the streetcars, the subways, all that stuff, in order to have more land mass where they won't have to go and start rezoning, but rather start anew, which respectfully they are not doing. Just on the flip side of that, when it comes to the rental housing market, the ban on foreign home ownership for 2 years from the federal government, I think, was a step in the right direction. If you go to Toronto and you talk to real estate agents and you talk to realtors and you ask about the housing market, they will tell you a large proportion, an astronomically large proportion of the condos in Toronto are empty, uninhabited. They are bought and they are put aside because they're bought as investments and people don't want to either rent them out. They don't want to deal with tenants. They don't want to get a property manager, blah, 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 blah. So that aspect alone is an indicator that maybe the issue is not only about creating new housing, but gaining access to already built housing that is not being used. So there's a lot of different avenues that governments can go through. And I think they're going to have to look at more than one approach at a time and not just start picking and choosing whatever they feel suits them, but whatever suits the people.
That's an excellent point that it's not only about building new houses, it's also about gaining access to the ones that are already there and the units that are seen as investment properties that may not necessarily be helping very much when it comes to youth and housing. And this all ties into the next question. And from your perspective, as someone who works directly with youth and advocates for them, what do you think are the long-term impacts for this on youth?
So, by far, one of the main aspects is financially. Whether they're able to get a mortgage that they m may not be able to pay off, whether they're going to be stuck in debt for the rest of their lives, or, and this is something that coming from, and I've heard it a lot that people from privileged backgrounds or older generations come, well, you're spending all this money on rent, that's enough for a mortgage. Okay, where's the down payment? So you're stuck in a rat race where you're never going to be able to afford a mortgage. You're never going to be able to afford the down payment because you're paying so much for rent. So realistically, in the long run, even if you're going to have changes in the future that make prices go down, people are going to have spent so much money on rent, it's no longer feasible for them to save up and buy a house. That's the unfortunate truth of it. And people. And this is the intergenerational aspect that comes into it, is it's a very different time in terms of salary, inflation, about where we live versus our parents' time, our grandparents' time. So we're facing this issue, and it's not like, oh, it's the same issue that they had. No, you had fair salaries, you had fair rent, you had more control, you had more government intervention, especially after World War II up until the 1980s, because the government cared about it because it saw the effects of a housing crisis when people came back from war. They've seen it and they actually stepped in. So it's not an impossible situation. It's not a new situation. It's just reprioritizing it and to really have governments be on the back, on the side, and have the back of Canadians and younger Canadians especially.
So building on from that, I just wanted to, as talking about long-term goals, I wanted to sort of bring the discussion to non-governmental organizations and and you can bring in your relevant experience here. I would say what do you think are would be the most effective short-term or long and long-term policies that NGOs should lobby for to either the municipal, provincial, or federal government to make housing more affordable, for youth? What would be the most effective, let's say, three policies that you would want the NGOs like to organize around and lobby for to make housing more affordable?
So one aspect of it will be foreign home ownership. Where do we stand on that? Because if Canadians find housing market inaccessible, then so should foreign home owners. And I'm not talking about like foreigners as in people who aren't Canadian. I'm talking about people who don't reside in Canada. Okay. And those who do not reside in Canada are literally buying it in order to benefit from the commodification of the market. So a 2-year ban, like realistically, is laughable. It's a joke. It's not really going to do anything. But if you bring in that legislation and you push it, and then it's only, basically Canadians are able to buy houses, Canadians who are living here, who need them, who will most likely live in them, and all that, that is a very important policy. In addition to that, we need to see a greater emphasis on prioritizing first-time homeowners before the second, third, fourth, fifth people who are just adding to their portfolio. You need to have applicable legislation that looks at it and gives an edge up to those people buying a house for the very first time. And this comes back to my earlier point where it's like you have provinces or you have legislation or ideas put forward by the government that sometimes you look at it and you think it's a bit tone deaf. Like you have the launching a tax-free first home savings account. I'm sorry, but the taxes on my savings account isn't what's hindering me right now. It's about nothing's going into that account, even if you give it to me. I don't have the money to put into that account to save up for a first-time home because the prices are so astronomical. So I would say you really need a push for that first-time initiatives. Secondly, is you see a lot of push for government-funded housing or, government building housing. And I'm not so sure that's the best course of action. One, government is extremely slow at doing anything. Two, government is very cheap sometimes. They will not be putting in enough money or adequate amount of funding in order to do so. So I would like to see more private-public partnerships between the government and between what's it called? MNCs or developers or all those things that pushes for kind of bringing in that funding for it. In the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, we saw the Vancity Community Investment Bank and the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation announce a significant partnership of around $118 million. This was going to go into financing over 1,100 units of affordable homes. And because of this partnership, it included things such as innovative solutions that we've never seen before, including like a Trillium Housing Shared Appreciation Second Mortgage, which basically is there to help modest income families with home ownership. And part of that also helped the community, like places like Jasper Place Wellness Center or Habitat for Humanity Canada, in helping them increase affordable housing by going into partnership with these NGOs as well. So you have positive in terms of having the private-public relationship, not because you have corporations that are so kind and so open-hearted and they want to help, but because it's great for the corporate social policy. When they put it, when they post it, when they announce it, when they market it, when they do all this stuff, it looks great on them. Benefit from that. I don't care why they're doing it. I care that they are doing it. So if we can capitalize on that, phenomenal.
Yes, that's a good point. And especially initiatives that are targeted towards first-time homeowners, and also how you mentioned government-built housing and how you propose that this might not necessarily be the best solution. Our next question was going to talk about exactly what you put in your point about the role of public-private partnerships and how these contribute to addressing the housing crisis. And since you've already touched on this issue, I'm wondering what your thoughts are, just to shift back to the government-built housing side of things. As we've seen, Olivia Chow, the mayor of Toronto, has proposed various ideas within this realm. What are your thoughts?
In terms of Toronto, there are a lot of great policies on, I guess, put forward. But I don't understand how a lot of them could be achieved if the city of Toronto does not have a positive relationship with the federal and provincial government. Because in Toronto especially, is you've almost reached, I want to say, the stagnation in terms of the how much housing you can build. I know they're expanding and they're building more condominiums, they're building more buildings, building all those things, but anything being built right now will not have rental control. So yeah, great, you're building, you have more buildings. Who can afford to live in those buildings? There's multiple municipalities that have been putting in requirements for a certain percentage of affordable housing, but a lot of those stipulations are for the first two, for the first, second, and third years of them being built. So when we're looking at that, it's like a band-aid, on a bullet wound. Nothing's really going to happen unless you have greater legislation and you stop building things without rental control. And this is just something that's so phenomenal to me, is that rental control is such a basic aspect of controlling a housing crisis. I get it. A lot, some developers withdrew their funding, withdrew the development of certain things unless rental control was taken out. But you have really hurt a huge portion of the population who are going to be moving into those, who are going to be overextending themselves in order to get those apartments, and are going to be at the whim of landlords in terms of increasing their rent. So I'd say the first step for any municipality or provincial government is to really take a look at rental control as just an aspect to stop the extortion of renters in the cities.
Just building upon that, I just wanted to ask one last question, which was about, in your experience, one of the biggest resources that the youth have is to go out to the municipal, to city halls, be involved in municipal elections, also be involved in like elections as a whole, like provincial, federal, play a role. But like, what are some other resources that you believe can help youth get access to housing affordability? And are there any valuable non-for-profit or government resources that the youth can access? And like, just to wrap it up, like your final thoughts, that would be nice.
So overall, although it looks bleak, I do have hope in, Canadian policy towards housing. The way I see it is Canada is slow at solving issues, but once it does, it really solves them. So right now we're seeing, a really, I don't want to say worst of it, but I will say a really bad part of it. But I do have hope that we're going to slowly come out of it. I know recently the government has been tabling a new mortgage proposal, to try to make it easier for people to take mortgages, increase the amount that they can or get mortgages. I still think that could be a slippery slope. It's really just trying to have people overextend themselves even more. But it's a step in the right direction of they're looking at these old practices that were applicable back in the day, and they're starting to really change them. And I think that's really what it is. It's a modernization of what we've had, and that's really the kind of step, the direction we need to go into. It's definitely not enough, but we're starting to see a movement in the right direction in terms of the federal government. We also want to see the same thing with the provincial government and municipal governments, and we want to see a lot more from federal governments, in the future and currently, because all in all, this problem is only going to keep getting worse. And the problem with the information that you were talking about, being available and all those things, one of the main issues I will say about not just the housing crisis, but in general of people in Canada, is a lot of people don't know what rights they do have. They don't understand what is at their disposal. I've had so many people come up and, have conversations with them, and they're like, yeah, I'm not allowed to have, a pet. I'm like, why are you not allowed to pet? Oh yeah, they stipulated that in my contract. Realistically, your contract stipulation of a pet from a landlord, unless the building says no, isn't really going to be held up in court. That's not part of their jurisdiction. That's not part of their ability to do so. So that's not part of the limitations that they can impose. So when we're looking at all these different things, is people don't have a solid grasp of what their rights are. They don't have a solid grasp of how to reach out for help when they need it. And this is the main issue that Canada has with all the programs that they have available to people. People can't access them. If you've ever tried to go onto the Government of Canada website and access a piece of information that you want, you will open 37 tabs to get to that one piece of information. It is tedious and it is slow and it is draining. So the access to information that is available out there is not easy and is not straightforward. That all needs to change. So there really needs to be a modernization of everything and a re-education for the people to understand what their rights are, how to access their rights, how to access their programs, and to fully understand where they stand and who they can go to in times of help, which we don't have. So the housing crisis is part of it, but another part of it is education for the programs that you have available. For example, if I want to benefit from the First Time Home Buyers Act, even if it's just 40,000, which well is a drop in the ocean for the cost of a house here, I'm going to have to really study up on how to activate. The application process is not easy. The link to find the application process is not readily available. So you already have so much red tape and bureaucratic hurdles just as a citizen trying to access these programs. So there's this one thing I'll leave it with is it's about making it easier for people to access housing. That's the one statement I will say. Whether it be in terms of the policy that you implement to increase the amount of housing, whether it be, easing the process to gain access to programs that make it easier, or whatever it is, the governments need to make it easier for Canadians, especially young Canadians, to be able to access affordable housing that they can call their own and that they can feel stable, secure in.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Once again, that was Jad Al-Khali, who joined us for a discussion on the housing crisis in Toronto. Thank you for tuning in for Beyond the Headlines. Remember, you can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us on Twitter at Beyond underscore headlines, checking out our website, www.beyondtheheadlines.net, or by following us on Instagram at Beyond the Headlines. Thank you for joining us. Now to conclude, in the last year alone, Canada's population has increased by more than 1.1 million. With every home built, there is a corresponding infrastructure that is needed. Thus, housing is an urgent concern for Canadians, since affordability is worsening, homelessness surging, and the dream of home ownership continuing to slip away for many. The federal government must move more aggressively to solve the housing crisis. It brings us back to the conversation that no one level of government controls all the policy levels that affect both the demand and supply for housing. And is one of the things that's made this such tricky problem, and there's been a lot of finger pointing. Maybe we need some kind of national roundtable or unified plan where the federal government, the provinces, and some of the bigger municipalities get together and agree on reforms. Now, you have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. We were joined today by Jad Al-Khali. Many thanks to them for coming onto the show to discuss Toronto's resilience strategy and future steps we need to take in to maintain the resilience. Today's show was produced by our team Audrey alongside my pretty co-producers, Steffi and Mehdi. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you are listening. The views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producer, CIUT, or the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any part of the show, be sure to check out podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with public policy issues in Canada, follow us on Twitter at Beyond underscore headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook or Instagram. Next week, we bring you our next conversation about another topic. Thank you very much.